This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Everyone is exposed everywhere, every time, to toxic chemicals. The big challenge is to try to minimize these exposures.
It is in the food, the water, the environment, domestic pollution, industrial pollution.
There's been an over 15-fold increase in chemicals that are manufactured or imported into the United States since the 1950s. And that rise coincides with the rise that we're seeing in a number of different chronic conditions.
Doctors, as well as the public, they are totally unaware of the influence of environmental toxin on an individual. For example, a number of people dying of renal disease prematurely at the age of 30, 35, 40, because 20 years ago they were pumping agrochemicals and pesticides, and it just went into the ground and spoiled the water supply. They didn't know what they were drinking, and now they are suffering from renal disease.
This opinion by FIGO is based on scientific evidence, and it's really important that obstetricians and gynecologists, who are the main physicians for women and women's health, are informed about the facts.
We have seen changes in cancer rates, thyroid disorders, miscarriages, large increases in ADHD, autism rates, deformities of the penis, such as hypospadias, decrease in sperm counts.
At the 21st FIGO World Congress in Vancouver, 7,000 physicians, midwives, and healthcare professionals gathered to explore global trends in maternal and child health. A top item of discussion: how to reduce exposure to toxic chemicals worldwide.
Testicular cancer was going through the roof across Europe. You know, and the hard evidence like that is, you know, wow, this is serious.
We can't expect cures. We need to be much more thoughtful about prevention.
Many people just assume that chemicals must have been tested before they were released into the environment, and therefore they must be safe. And that really isn't the case.
There are different times during development, and also as a child, adolescent, and as an adult, that individuals can be exposed to toxic chemicals that can change the course of development or the ability to reproduce or the course of a pregnancy, and also can change human health, not only for the generation that is affected, but also for subsequent generations.
The science, physicians around the world say, can no longer be ignored.
There's been an explosion in our technological ability to measure industrial chemicals in people. What they found was not just one, two, three, four, but dozens of industrial chemicals measured inside of people, in children and in pregnant women, so that babies are now being born pre-polluted with a number of different industrial chemicals that have been measured in cord blood.
We've got to shift the burden of proof from the lay public, the scientists, the physicians like me, back to the chemical industry.
The reality is there is no law in the United States right now that requires that chemicals be fully tested before they're used in products that come into our home, and so we're inadvertently exposing our children to a lot of these different types of industrial chemicals, and we're paying the price in terms of our health.
In Scotland, following the ban on smoking in public places, there was a 15% reduction in preterm birth. For very preterm children, it declined by 25%. This was much greater than any of us expected. And what it shows is that even very low-level exposure to toxins can have a big impact on preterm birth.
When lead in the United States was banned from gasoline, the lead levels in gasoline went down at the same time that the lead levels in children went down. Together.
So what can you do?
There are real things we can do to reduce exposures, but we have to engage, and we have to do research, and we have to have patients and doctors having this kind of counseling happen, the same way we counsel about birth control pills and, healthy diet and healthy lifestyles.
There are some things that the patient can't control. A good example is air pollution. We know air pollution is linked to adverse health effects all across the lifespan, starting with reproduction and development. But one person cannot stop air pollution themselves.
Pesticides in various foods, as well as the injection of hormones in the animals. Ultimately, anything which is chemical is going to affect the health of women and children.
Giving a voice to the people who are kind of in the trenches, so the the workers who are working with pesticides and have no masks, they can be given a stronger voice.
Physicians and other healthcare professionals are needed on the front lines of this effort.
This is, as I said, a very big task in teaching to our future obstetrician gynecologists. If they know this in the school, in the resident school, in the school of medicine, I think that this will change the impact of environment toward ourselves and ourselves toward the environment. And we'll be more respectful at the end.
This is a global problem that needs a global solution, so it's time to act on a global scale.
I'm really hoping that our generation of doctors will take on the issue of environmental health so that we can see healthy babies and healthy moms for generations to come.
We'd like to begin today with a very special inaugural lecture of the Markku Seppälä Ovidaan Lecture. Dr. Seppälä is a past president of FIGO. Coming from Finland, he has been a huge contributor to our society. His family have sponsored a lectureship for many years, but now we have this endowed lectureship, which we're very, very pleased to have such good attendance for today. And we are particularly thrilled that we have Professor Linda Judice as our inaugural lecturer this morning. Dr. Judice is the professor and chair of obstetrics and gynecology and of reproductive sciences at the University of California at San Francisco. She is a reproductive endocrinologist of international renown and a biochemist. She is the foremost champion in this field of environmental toxins on reproductive health, a topic that you'll be having the opportunity to learn quite a bit about at this meeting, and there is a position paper that FIGO has released that Linda is the senior author on, and I think you will find helpful to take home with you. Dr. Judice is a past president of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, and she is the current president of the World Endometriosis Society. She is an elected member of the American Institute of Medicine, which is now called the Academy of Medicine. She has numerous publications. She has been awarded and recognized for her fantastic contributions, and we are very, very pleased and honored that she is speaking to us this morning.
Thank you, Professor Blake. I also would like to thank Dr. Joanna Kane for extending this invitation, and I am really thrilled to be here today to be part of the FIGO Congress and also to give this inaugural lecture. It's particularly special to me to have the Markku Seppälä lectureship because Professor Seppälä influenced my career early on with his investigation in human endometrium. And that's where I have spent most of my career in research in human endometrium and endometriosis. These are my disclosures. And today I'm not going to talk to you about endometrium or endometriosis, but I will be talking about the environment. And you may ask, why am I giving this presentation? Well, first, I'm giving it as a physician in reproductive medicine. as a reproductive endocrinologist and someone who was challenged by a patient about a decade ago who wanted to know if her repetitive miscarriages could have derived from her growing up on Love Canal in New York State, which is a Superfund site, highly contaminated in persistent organic pollutants. And she inspired me to begin to build work with many others around the country and now around the world, really questioning what is happening to our health and our reproductive health from these insults. And also, basically, I am a concerned citizen of the world. So today, I would like to review with you the link between human health and human reproductive health, and non-communicable disease trends affecting both, discuss evidence of endocrine-disrupting chemical effects and air pollution on health and reproduction, and then to share with you some strategies about moving the needle on reproductive and developmental health globally. So health affects reproduction, and reproduction affects health. There are multiple factors that affect each and both. And we know that, for instance, a pregnant woman who has diabetes or hypertension or other non-communicable diseases, that these impact on not only her pregnancy course, but also on the development of the fetus and the child. And in addition to health affecting reproduction affecting health, we also know that health policy and other policies affect our health. So what is the global report card? How does it look? Over the past 50 years, there's been a marked increase in non-communicable diseases, including obesity and diabetes, neurodevelopmental disorders, reproductive compromise, respiratory and thyroid dysfunction, and cancers, just to name a few. There has also been, concomitantly, a marked increase in unregulated global chemical production, chemical use, and chemical disposal. And there is increasing evidence that environmental chemicals, including endocrine-disrupting chemicals and air pollution, contribute not only to non-communicable disease, but also to developmental origins of health and disease, the so-called DOHAD or Barker hypothesis. Just looking now at a few trends globally about non-communicable diseases, we see that there's a marked increase in global trends from 1980 to 2020 of the worldwide prevalence of obesity that has nearly doubled. In addition, infant and young child overweight trends are actually quite remarkable and quite concerning. And this is true in middle-income countries, low-income countries, and high-income countries, and has been increasing over the last several decades. There's also a global increase in type 2 diabetes, and you can see the various regions. It's true for every continent. And overall, there's about a 40% increase that's occurred over a decade where data have been obtained. And another example is that there's a global increase in endocrine cancers, prostate cancer, for instance, in the UK, and breast cancer trends globally in a variety of countries. So the time frame, 50 to 100 years, is not really consistent with heritable genetic mutations at the global population level. So the question is, what is changing globally? There are numerous things changing. There's globalization. There are changes in nutrition and the use of ultra-processed foods. Air quality has changed. Personal behaviors and habits, with smoking, despite many campaigns and physicians being the group that has decreased the most in smoking behaviors, globally, this is a major problem. Diagnostic criteria have probably emerged and have been refined, as well as diagnostic technologies. And then finally, there are chemicals and chemical exposures, and that's what I would like to focus on today. I don't think that chemicals are responsible for all non-communicable diseases, but I do think that they contribute to them, as I'll show you in some data shortly. So let's take a look at the U.S. and global chemical production. There has been about an almost 25-fold increase in chemicals produced in the U.S. since World War II. In 2012, in the U.S., 9.5 trillion pounds of industrial chemicals domestically were manufactured and imported, roughly 30,000 pounds for each American. That's a staggering number. And most of these have undergone limited safety testing. Pesticides, for instance, are widely used, and they contain about 900 active ingredients. Chemicals in foods, there are about 3,000 of those. And then drugs and cosmetics contain about 5,000. And Dr. Linda Birnbaum, who is the director of the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences in the U.S., has really stated that chemicals, of course, do not undergo randomized control trials. They are released into the community and into the workforce after limited testing, but they're not like drugs. They do not have that rigor of evaluation. And she has stated that environmental chemicals act in many ways like uncontrolled medicine. Now, looking at the global chemical production, this will shift greatly by 2030, where over 50% of the chemical industry will be located in Asia and the Middle East. This is a slide from the journal Science. You may not be able to see all the details, but the code is that red is the highest amount of pesticides in kilograms per hectare of arable land. And you can see that certain areas have red circles. And interestingly, the U.S. consumes about 20% of pesticides, but the highest, or one of the highest concentrations, is in areas where there are valuable crops, such as in Colombia for the coffee growing, and interestingly, in the Netherlands for the development of Dutch tulips. In addition, pesticide expenditures are anticipated to skyrocket in Africa over the next decade. So I hope you have an appreciation that chemicals are being made everywhere, used everywhere, and they cross borders through trade, wind, food, and water. And there are inequities and injustices that prevail on toxic chemicals moving about the world, with the most vulnerable populations having usually the greatest exposures globally. Tracy Woodruff at our Program for Reproductive Health and the Environment has published a study about measurements in the population in the United States and also in pregnant women. And these data are from one of her publications, and others have also published on this. The findings are that in a select population that is thought to be generalizable to the larger population, that every person in the U.S. has measurable contaminants in their body. Mixtures are the rule. And contaminants are also found in pregnant women, including environmental tobacco smoke, lead, perfluorinated compounds, perchlorate, mercury, phthalates, and bisphenol A. And the U.S. Presidential Commission on the Evaluation of Cancer, besides concluding that the majority of cancers were either directly caused by or influenced by environmental toxins, made a statement that to a disturbing extent, babies are born pre-polluted. There are periods of vulnerability to disruption by environmental factors, and I think many of us are aware of the story of diethylstilbestrol and also the story of thalidomide. The prenatal period is a highly vulnerable period because of intense cellular mitosis and differentiation and organ formation, but also in the preconception period, the reproductive tracts of the parents and the gametes of the parents are also exposed to environmental chemicals that can affect offspring. And of course, little children, toddlers and younger than that, tend to spend a lot of time on the floor, crawling. And the floor usually contains dust, and dust is an incredible medium for the conveyance of environmental chemicals. So where and how do we get information about environmental chemicals? We get information from observations about wildlife and disruption of either reproduction or other processes. There are direct tests of chemicals that can be done in laboratories, either on cells or in animal models. And then with humans, we don't do randomized trials. It would be unethical to do so. So there are we usually get our information from epidemiologic data or from occupational exposures that have resulted in harm, or from some isolated industrial accidents that have affected populations. And in general, there's concordance of developmental effects between animals and humans, and animals are thought to be as sensitive or more sensitive to many of these compounds compared to other animal species. I'd like to focus a little bit on endocrine-disrupting chemicals, or EDCs. These are chemicals or mixtures of chemicals that interfere with any aspect of hormone action at any time of development and or during the life course. Now, there are many endocrine glands in the body. So what are some of the mechanisms underlying endocrine-disrupting chemicals? Well, some of them look like hormones, and they bind to hormone receptors. They can block the action of hormones. They can mimic hormone action. Some of them activate signaling pathways or repress signaling pathways. Some affect hormone clearance or binding to carrier transport proteins. And some may have something to do with honeybees. Yes, honeybees. So if we think about the development of the queen bee, really, it's when the larvae are put into a special medium called the royal jelly that a queen will develop from that particular nest, as opposed to a worker bee. And it's thought that it's not the genetic difference, but rather due to epigenetics. And that is a change in the DNA and gene expression that are not due to changes in the sequence. So it's not a T to an A or a C to a G, but rather somehow the DNA is being modified either by methylation or by acetylation of its histones or by other mechanisms that can open spots in the DNA that can allow transcription and other processes. And this is thought to be one of the primary mechanisms with regard to in utero development of adult disorders, and also the effects of some chemicals. Now, there is a connection between adult diseases and preconceptual and prenatal exposure to endocrine-disrupting chemicals. And I'd like to take a minute just to point out that environmental contaminants that persist, that were banned many years ago, such as PCBs, but also dioxins and others, tributyl tin, and plasticizers, and pesticides, and preservatives, and sanitizers, and air pollution. You may not think of these classically as endocrine disruptors, but they are. And in fact, they now have been identified, some of them, not all of them, as obesogens, i.e., contributing to obesity, diabetogens, contributing to diabetes, reproductive disruptors, thyroid disruptors, and neurodevelopmental disruptors. So here on this slide, I've tried to list some of the obesogens to which exposure prenatally can disrupt homeostatic control of fat organogenesis, so adipogenesis, energy balance, and in animal models cause obesity. In addition, epidemiologic data associate endocrine-disrupting chemicals such as bisphenol A and phthalates with obesity in humans. And animal models also show that EDCs can alter insulin production, secretion, function, action, and type 2 diabetes. So we don't usually think of obesity having an environmental component, and what the extent of that environmental component is not clear, but we do have evidence that there is a contribution. Now, this is a very interesting mouse, the agouti mouse, where studies have shown that the maternal diet can influence fetal development. So when the pregnant mother is fed a diet that is rich in methyl donors, she has on the upper box on the right side offspring that are predominantly brown and in good health. However, if she is fed the usual mouse chow, the ratio of the pups changes, and the offspring mainly look like the mother and are in poorer health. And that's just based on diet. Now, when the agouti mouse is exposed to bisphenol A, which is an endocrine-like disruptor, this triggers the agouti mouse, and there's a higher ratio of the yellow obese progeny than expected. There's global DNA hypomethylation, and the agouti gene itself has a decrease in methylation, which is thought to increase the expression of that gene. But the good news is that methyl donors rescue the phenotype. So there is a certain amount of environmental protection in this model that folic acid and vitamin B12 rescue the phenotype, increase the DNA methylation, with a resulting normalization of the pup ratio. BPA exposure is not limited to effects on the agouti mouse. Very recently in endocrinology this year, the group from the University of Pennsylvania published that BPA exposure disrupts metabolic health across multiple gestations in the mouse due to the stable inheritance of DNA methylation in the IGF-2 locus, a very important growth factor in fetal growth. And these DNA methylation changes can essentially be passed on generation to generation, which is thought to be the basis of this inheritance. Now, endocrine disruptors can affect neurodevelopment, behavior, and IQ. And there are critical periods of neurodevelopment that occur in the first trimester of pregnancy in humans in terms of neuronal growth and neuron differentiation. And then in the second half of pregnancy, neural migration, connectivity, and myelination occurring just before birth and then continuing throughout a good portion of childhood. There are significant data that underscore the role of endocrine disruptors in almost every part of these pathways in animal models. And this is something that I think we as obstetrician gynecologists and other healthcare professionals, as we'll get to later, as we counsel our patients, it's important to think about in pregnant women the developing fetus and the health of the fetus, and long-term, the health of the child and adult. A paper was just published, and there are many papers on the effects of EDCs on neurodevelopmental health, but this paper is quite interesting in that it reported on the relation of prenatal methylmercury exposure from environmental sources to childhood IQ. You probably know that mercury is a naturally occurring metal. It's also increased in large amounts in coal-burning power plants, and the pollution goes to the ground, the bacteria metabolize it, they form methylmercury, which is then taken up by the fish, and it goes up the food chain into people. In this study, they estimated the IQ in 282 school children in Arctic Quebec, and these children had had their cord blood obtained and analyzed for mercury and other environmental exposures. And what they found was that the prenatal mercury exposure correlated with poorer IQ after adjustment for confounders, and that children whose cord blood levels of methylmercury were greater than 7.5 milligrams per liter were four times more likely to have an IQ of less than 80, which is the clinical cutoff for intellectual disability. There are many other chemicals, disorders that can be affected by endocrine-disrupting chemicals, and I've summarized here sensitive developmental periods when EDC exposures greatly increase the risk of female reproductive disorders. These include PCOS, meiotic disruption in oogenesis, endometriosis, uterine fibroids, lactation duration, early foetal arc, and premature menarche. And you can see from the blue boxes that if the exposure is during organogenesis and in the neonatal period, there is a higher risk of developing some of these disorders, and also in the reproductive years. So there are two periods that we tend to focus on the most, and that is the developmental periods, in utero, early childhood, and also adolescence, but also the effects of chemicals directly on reproductive processes in the adult. EDCs also affect the male reproductive system. I think everyone knows that insulin-like 3 androgens, AMH, and estradiol drive testicular descent, and anti-androgens and estrogens and dioxins are the main reproductive disruptors, mainly because androgens drive external genitalia masculinization. The work of Shauna Swan over the years has demonstrated that human fetal prenatal exposure to phthalates, such as in cosmetics, but there are other sources, feminizes male external genitalia. Now, these are very hard studies to do, because what she did was measure the anogenital distance and the penile length in male infants and children in various cohorts. And the anogenital distance is a subtle measure of normal male reproductive tract development and a sensitive measure of prenatal antiandrogen exposure, shifting from a more male-like external genitalia to a more female-like. And I say these are difficult studies to do because usually when a baby is born, either the obstetrician or the pediatrician or the nurse will look at the external genitalia, but nobody is measuring anogenital distance. So doing these kinds of studies is difficult, and getting normative data is quite a challenge. But these are very interesting observations. Also, with regard to the male, BPA levels are higher in mothers of boys with cryptorchidism. Persistent organic pollutants in adipose tissue are associated with cryptorchidism in early childhood. This is a recent study. Environmental levels of phthalates in infertile men are associated with increased rates of human sperm DNA damage, low sperm counts, and other parameters. And BPA levels correlate with decreased sperm counts. In addition, with regard to trends, globally, hypospadias has had a significant increase over a 25-year period, and malformations of the male reproductive system externally are the most common form of birth defect. Whether they're all due to endocrine disruptors is unclear, but there may be a role for them. In addition, in certain parts of the world, not everywhere, primarily in Northern Europe, there have been reported the trends shown here with regard to a marked increase in testicular germ cell tumors. Niels Gekkebak and other colleagues have put together these male data into what's called the testicular dysgenesis syndrome, going from impaired spermatogenesis to undescended testis, to also include hypospadias, and in the most severe form, severe testicular dysgenesis syndrome. I think it's important to point out that, again, this is not applicable everywhere in the world, but certainly there are hot spots that warrant attention. EDCs also affect sex ratios in humans. Usually, the population is pretty evenly balanced, 50-50, male and female. However, when fathers are exposed to wood preservatives, there's a decrease in the male-to-female ratio. Or with exposure to dioxin, or TCDD, or Agent Orange in war zones, again, a decrease in the ratio, and a number of others. And these are data that are hard to get, but I think really warrant attention. Last year, Ruth Latte at Stanford and Vic Fujimoto at our institution published with other colleagues on maternal serum BPA levels being positively associated with miscarriage risk in women. And I think we're all familiar with the effects of environmental tobacco smoke on the adult ovary, with decreased ovarian reserve, decreased success in IVF, earlier menopause by 1 to 4 years, via mechanisms that are fairly well worked out. On the pregnancy side, environmental tobacco smoke has a positive association with increased miscarriage rate, low birth weight, preterm birth, and now is being found to be transgenerational. Maternal phthalate exposure is associated with increased odds of preterm birth. And there is a recent review in Environment International this year that reviewed 35 studies and found that preterm birth and also anogenital distance were most commonly reported outcomes from moderate levels of exposure to phthalates. The main metabolites detected were DEHP and DNBP, and for those thinking about doing research in this area, their comment was that urine is the most suitable matrix to assess the association of in utero exposure to phthalates and pregnancy outcomes. It's easy to get, it's non-invasive, and also you can sample frequently. The caveat, however, is that there are other chemicals, of course, that are fat-soluble and may not be appropriately assayed in something like the urine. And this is a relatively recent study that was published in which biomass fuels, wood fuel, high in carbon monoxide and other gases, are associated with preterm birth in East India. And so the internal environment, just over cooking stoves, can affect pregnancy outcome. And this is another study from Tracy Woodruff from our group and a collaboration of several others across the world, in which they did a meta-analysis of more than 3 million births and looked at maternal exposure to particulate air pollution and term birth weight. And basically what they found is that particulate matter of 2.5 had a positive association, odds ratio, with low birth weight. So when you put all this together, the one thing that's been missing from most of these studies is not, in addition to the human cost, is also what is the economic cost. And there's a series of papers in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism this year looking at the costs of endocrine-disrupting chemicals causing illnesses. What they found in their model was that the cost in the EU, medical, work loss, and other, totaled somewhere between 157 to 270 billion euros per year. And the biggest cost driver was the loss of IQ and intellectual disabilities caused by prenatal exposure to organophosphate pesticides. In addition, about 13 million lost IQ points and 59,000 additional cases of intellectual disability per year were attributed to organophosphate exposures. They also found that adult obesity was linked to phthalate exposure that generated the second highest total of 15.6 billion euros per year. And their voice, along with an increasing number of voices, has been that we need regulation of commercial and industrial chemical use, disposal, and recycling in developed and developing countries. So the question arises, what can we do? So far, this talk has been pretty depressing. But I'm an optimist. I think we can do something, and there are others who share that. One question is, might green chemistry help? Green chemistry replaces hazardous chemicals, processes, and products with supposedly safer alternatives. DES and BPA, which are sort of in the same family, have some green chemistry cousins, BPS and BPF. However, two papers came out, one in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences last year and one in Fertility and Sterility this year, that have demonstrated that they are not any better. In fact, they are worse. So a lot of work really needs to be done when we're thinking about green chemistry alternatives. Well, we know that actions can reduce exposures. This shows what happened when lead was taken out of gasoline in the United States. And then over time, the population level blood levels decreased over time. But this was not a simple decision. It was a saga of over almost 40 years of advocacy, getting the evidence, and basically education of legislators, and finally affecting change. So there is mounting evidence that what I have presented just a glimpse of today matters, and the time to act is now, and we need to act on a more global level. And we, as physicians and other healthcare providers and researchers and nurses, we can do this. The data, the monographs shown here include a textbook, an early textbook that we put out in 2008, the monograph from the Endocrine Society published in 2009. EDC2 is just being published this year with an update. The WHO and UNEP published the Endocrine Disrupting Chemicals 2012, an update from their previous assessments. WHO also has published possible developmental and early effects of endocrine disruptors on human health. The Endocrine Society has a monograph on introduction to endocrine disrupting chemicals for legislators and how to talk to legislators about this and ministers of health. And the brochures you see there come from our program on reproductive health and the environment at UCSF, led by Dr. Tracy Woodruff. All of these are free. They're online. We've had over 100,000 of these downloaded because these are brochures about toxic matters in pregnancy and daily life, at the workplace, pesticides, and also one translation into Spanish. And we now include one of these in our prenatal packets so that women are informed, and these brochures are based on evidence, so evidence-based recommendations for patients. Professional organizations are really starting to take paying attention to this. The Royal College in 2013 came out with an opinion on chemical exposures during pregnancy. The International Conference on Children's Health and Environment in Jerusalem in November 2013 issued a paper on the commitment to protect children's health from environmental hazards. And of course, the pediatricians are years ahead of us. They have the Green Book, which is the environmental health book for children. The American College of OBGYN, shown in the top upper right, has a committee opinion on lead screening in pregnancy. The American College and the American Society of Reproductive Medicine issued a conjoint committee opinion on reproductive health and the environment. And FIGO now is, just with this lecture, I think is quite a statement about the interest of environmental impacts on reproductive health. So this is the monograph that was just published last week in the International Journal of Gynecology and Obstetrics. The first author is Professor Giancarlo DiRenzo, and it's called the International Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics Opinion on Reproductive Health Impacts of Exposure to Toxic Environmental Chemicals. This was an incredible collaboration among representatives from several groups around the world, and you can see it was endorsed by 12 OBGYN women's health organizations around the globe. So what were the recommendations? The first recommendation was to advocate for policies to prevent exposure to toxic environmental chemicals. The second was work to ensure a healthy food system for all. The third was to make environmental health part of healthcare. And the fourth was to champion for environmental justice. These are not trivial recommendations, and I think they're actually quite thoughtful and very visionary. Just this past Sunday, here at FIGO, we had a summit called Shaping Our Planetary Legacy, Setting an Agenda for Environmental Reproductive Health. It was attended by many representatives of 22 countries and territories, at this summit, and the purpose of the summit was to begin to lay the foundations for the agenda for the new FIGO Reproductive and Developmental Environmental Health Working Group, which is a group that, sorry, it doesn't go backwards, it's a group that will be forming. And the challenges to it are to consider how we can approach these four recommendations and others by advocacy, by training and infrastructure building, and also in research. So in conclusion, toxic environmental chemicals happen every day, everywhere, and harm the capacity for healthy humans and healthy reproduction. Preventing exposures should be a high priority for reproductive health professionals everywhere. But we can't just shop our way out of this. We can't just eat the right things and avoid certain personal care products. We also need policy changes. Environmental chemicals cross borders, through, as we mentioned before, trade, food, wind, and water, with inequities and injustices as they distribute around the world. So a global perspective is needed to ensure equity and health for all, and we need policies to address toxic chemicals that must shift the burden of proof of safety from the individual and the public to the manufacturers. Policies that address toxic chemicals must protect the health also of vulnerable populations. And we must not forget the rest of the world we live in, that policies that address toxic chemicals should protect the environment that sustains the potential for human existence across generations. So I ask you to work with us, to think about these things, to begin to be more aware. There are simple things one can advise patients about: smoking, avoiding particular personal care products, trying to live a more healthy lifestyle. And I think overall, it's time to take action, and I think that we can do it together. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Judice. I think there is time for a few questions, and Dr. Judice has offered to take them. If you would like to please go to the microphone and preferably identify yourself.
Okay, sorry, excuse my ignorance in that. I hope others have it. When you were telling us about the environmental effects, I personally don't know what a BDE or DDA or a phyla is. Can you convert that to real life product or food or some of this environmental chemicals that you mentioned? I don't know where it is. What do people eat it, drinking it? Is it hair dye? Can you just enlighten us a little, please, if you don't mind? My patient always asks me about the hair dye. What's the effect of that?
That's a great question. My patients ask me also about hair dye in particular, and it's usually the darker hair dye. Patients are advised to try to minimize exposures to red hair dyes or dark hair dyes, mainly because there's some connection with thyroid disruption. The scalp, as you know, is highly vascularized, and there's ready absorption through the scalp. But there are various chemicals, for instance, phthalates in the lining of certain cans. So if people eat canned foods, many of the cans now say phthalate-free. In addition, plastic food wrap, when it's touching food, can leach some chemicals. Plastic bottles, if they contain liquids and they're sitting in the sun for hours, will leach a considerable amount of bisphenol A. And there was a study done that showed that if one has drunk some water from one of those bottles and then touched the receipts from a cash register, which has additional BPA, that the levels are increased exponentially. So doing things that are somewhat common sense, I think, are appropriate. We don't want anyone to think that it's, you know, so challenging to live in the world, because chemicals are all around us. And I think the best answer to many of the questions is to apply the precautionary principle, that if you don't have the hard data, at least try to be as sensible as possible about minimizing exposures to specific chemicals. There are websites. The Environmental Working Group has a website about different cosmetics and what they contain and how they're rated with regard to either cancer or reproduction. So there are resources that patients can be referred to as well.
Yeah, so I'm coming from Europe. And in Europe, we have the precautionary principle, and we know that it is still hard to implement when it comes to policy changes. So which obstacles do you see for the implementation of the precautionary principle, and which recommendations would you make so that it is really implemented?
So are you asking about how to approach policy change?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's not easy, but I think one of the most compelling avenues to go down is to engage those, whether they are ministers of health or others who are responsible for not only health policy, but also environmental policies, with regard to what the facts are. And it's amazing when legislators look at the data and see that certain things are happening, that they at least are enlightened, but the next step is not usually an acceptance of changing policy. So there needs to be a lot of discussion, negotiation, and you really need to have advocates and champions. And I know in our state of California, we have many things that go before our state legislature, and when physicians speak up and when professional organizations are present, the legislators listen, and we've been able to affect change at various levels. But it does require collaboration, and it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for a wonderful lecture. I wonder, as I understand you have mainly speaking about hormonal influence, but what about all the additives to industrial processed food who change the gut flora of microbes? Shouldn't we also include all this? It's an emerging new science there. Many chronic diseases, maybe not on fetal level, but changing the gut flora.
Yes, that's a really good point. There's only one publication that I'm aware of where a chemical, and I think it may have been BPA, was administered in an animal model, and the gut microbiome was disturbed or perturbed. But it is a field in its infancy, and it may very well be if it's not a direct effect, but rather a surrogate effect, where the direct effect may actually be on the gut and the microbiome of the gut, which is thought to have to play a role in terms of metabolism and immune defense. Very good point. Thank you.
We've got microphone 5. Microphone 5.
It is, hello. Hi, my name is William Atiamu. I'm from Nottingham. How are we sure this is just not another passing trend? Take my research area, for example, polycystic ovary syndrome. We've been through genetics, epigenetics, fetal programming. I mean, in one of your slides, you mentioned some research linking EDCs and PCSOS to problems with EDCs in organogenesis. Can you just shed some more light on that? Where's that research from?
Sure. The research specifically is in sheep, and the sheep were administered androgens antenatally, and they developed a polycystic appearing ovary. Of course, you're probably aware of how that is defined. It's quite variable in the literature. But they also developed type 2 diabetes and obesity. And so, and there are other data in other animal models. I'm not aware of any data from humans. But again, this is not to demonstrate a cause and effect for every single chemical, but rather as classes of chemicals in different models where there can be an effect that has a comparable physiologic process in humans, that there is some biological plausibility.
With that, I would like to once again thank Dr. Judice. At that summit on Sunday, one of the scientists present said, you know, in male reproductive research, we've known about this and we've been working on this for the past 20 years. It's about time that you started paying attention to this problem in women's reproductive health. I think with this lecture, we have had a call to action, and I look forward to great progress being made in a very complex but important area. Thank you very, very much for your lecture. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.